Welcome back to another episode of the Profitable Audience Podcast. Today, going to be a kind of self-serving episode for me.
Today, we're going to talk about Steve. Right before, as he hit the record button, he said, "Do you want to do the intro?" And I was like, "No, you always do the intro," because I did the intro with Andrea's podcast. And when I listened to it, I was like, "Oh, that's just not a great intro. It's not, it doesn't have the energy."
Well, this one wasn't that good either.
It wasn't, but... Welcome to another episode of the Profitable Audience Podcast. Today, you guys get a very special treat. I am going to interview the one and only Steve Chu. Apparently, there's a rumor that he has written a book.
And what's cool is I actually just got it in hand. And
yes.
I don't know if we ever told the story about the cover design fiasco, but I got it back and it was really well done. Like the letters for Family First are all shiny and everything. So I'm really happy with it.
So there's some texture.
Texture to it, and there's some difference in shine, you know, in sheen. Yeah. Also,
I like it. It's funny because I don't know. Did you ever do any research on what book covers? How do book covers influence people's purchasing decisions?
Are you joking?
Like online or in the store? No, I mean, like, I'm sure there's studies on it as far as how much does covers matter. It's like wine label bottles. Most people buy the wine for the label and not the actual like quality of the wine.
The cover is everything.
Really?
I mean, for people that don't know,
we should have spent more time on this.
I did so when that first cover came back and I didn't like it, I did all this research on book covers and, you know, I did the whole split testing with PicFu and everything. And, you know, at first I was like, why yellow? Should I do yellow? And then I realized, you know, picking a bright color just makes it stand out, and a strong contrasting color makes the cover stand out. And then Cialdini use the exact same colors that I did. So that was like double reinforcement right there.
Had to be a good idea. So what's interesting about your color choices, because you used a bright yellow and a deep blue.
Yep.
I don't know if it's a navy blue, but it's a very deep blue. And I can remember back in college, 1992, this is how long ago this was, that in one of my political science classes, they talked about the amount of money spent on researching colors for signs, political signs, you know, that people put up before. I don't know if they allow this in California, but in Florida, like before an election, like the entire city is covered in like signs stuck into the ground. And the top converting colors for people were blue and gold, or blue and yellow.
Really?
Which was surprising to me because everyone uses red, white, and blue you know, but there's always someone who uses blue and yellow, and I'm like, they must have been in that class with me. That's how I do.
I think the key is really, I don't know if that study is true, maybe it is, but I looked on the front page for, you know, terms like small business books, entrepreneurship books, and all of them were approximately the same color. There are very few yellow ones. So my goal was just stand out, really. Among the crowd.
It'll stand out. Well, anyway, so you have the book in hand. No one else has it in hand, but you do. So let's start from the beginning. Why did you want to write a book? Because it's been very painful, at least for me.
Right, because it's all about you. Yeah. I have three reasons. So the first one is I've just felt like all the entrepreneurship advice and business advice out there is just given by single dudes with no responsibilities. And that's not what my life is like.
Your wife wouldn't appreciate that either.
Right? I mean, we got kids. You have a lot more than I do. We have responsibilities. We can't be working 60 to 80 hour weeks. And the traditional wisdom is that you have to hustle and work that hard to get ahead. And it just doesn't have to be that way. Because I've managed to carve out a system where I work maybe about 20 hours and make plenty of money, more than enough than what I spend. So that was reason number one, because I feel like there needs to be a 4-hour work week for families, so to speak, right?
Okay.
People with families. Second reason was I want my kids to be impressed with dad. So I want to walk them to the Barnes & Nobles, the only one left in the Bay Area. And, you know, show them that the book's on the shelf. I think that's pretty cool. Actually, when the books came, my daughter was like, "Hey, that's so cool. That's so cool. You have a book."
Yeah.
And then the third reason was I've been blogging for over a decade now, YouTube, podcasts. My mom to this day has not read or listened to a single thing. But when I told her about the book, she got all excited. And she was like, "Oh my God, where can I order? Wow. So is this going to be in a bookstore?" I'm like, yeah, of course, it's going to be in a bookstore. So I got mom props, which satisfies my, trauma growing up.
Yeah. So part of this is therapeutic. And so why now, though? I mean, you just said you've been blogging for 14 years. Why now did you decide that the book was the right move?
You know, for the longest time, I wasn't going to write the book. So to be honest, I actually wasn't planning on writing a book at this time because it just requires so much time and energy to actually do the writing. It was always on my bucket list, but I wasn't going to do it until my kids probably were off to college. Until I met Jeff Goins, who's someone I really respect as a writer. He's a best-selling author. And when he offered to help me with the book, I was like, okay, this is a sign that this needs to happen.
And so what sort of part did Jeff play in all of this?
Yeah, Jeff basically helped me collect everything that I've ever done, put together a proposal, a story, find an agent, shop for book deals, pretty much everything, actually. And without him, I wouldn't have been able to do this.
And does he get a cut? How does that work? Does he get a cut of the profits, or how does that work? Obviously, he's not doing this out of the goodness of his heart.
Yeah, no, he doesn't get a cut of the profit, but he just gets a flat fee for his services. Yeah.
And do a lot of people do this? Is this common for people to hire someone like Jeff?
I think it is common, actually, now that I've been talking with a whole bunch of people who have books. It is pretty common, especially if you know nothing. Like, I knew nothing about books, and you can't really just know nothing and go into the traditionally published space. You probably need help. You probably need an agent.
So Jeff's not the agent. The agent is
someone, and he gets a cut, actually.
Okay.
Of the profits, yeah.
And what does the agent do? They try to get you the deal?
Correct. The agent has all the connections with people in the traditionally published space, and he just has a really good Rolodex, and he helps out with just anything that involves negotiation.
So what happens first? Do you write the book first, and then you go to the pub? You have the agent shop it around, or you shop it? Like, walk through the timeline of the whole thing.
Yeah, so what you do is you put together the proposal first. And all you really need there is maybe like a tentative table of contents, a sample chapter, and then how many books you think you're going to sell. And like you specify all your audience size and all that stuff. And you're trying to convince the publisher that you can move books. Really.
How do you come up with that number? Like, how do you know how many? I mean, I would have no idea how many books. I would have a little bit of an idea because I've sold eBooks, but like most people probably have no clue how many books they could sell. And as you've said before, selling books is actually really hard.
Well, it's like if you were starting a company and you wanted to get funding and then you want to know how much your company is worth. It's kind of like that math.
You just make up a number?
I mean, it's not completely made up, but you know, based on the audience size and the reach, you just make some sort of estimate.
Okay. Yeah.
It's nothing.
So you put your proposal together, you make up your crazy numbers. You're like, I'm going to sell 10 million copies. Move over Prince Harry.
Okay. So that proposal took a whole year.
Yeah.
What
took a whole year about that? Because that doesn't seem like it would take very long at all to write the proposal or the whole process of shopping it as well.
No. The shopping part is quick. The proposal takes forever because it's basically your book. You come up with the title, you come up with the table of contents, all the organization. You write a sample chapter. I mean, that's most of the work right there. That's all planning.
Yeah.
The actual writing is just fill in the blanks. You already know what the chapters are about approximately. And you just,
How'd you come up with your chapters? Like, how did you do that?
I did together with Jeff. So he interviewed me and I basically gave him everything. Every podcast, access to the course, all the blog posts that I've ever written. And we just kind of talked it through. Again, that process took a long time. It was many calls. Mm-hmm. And, he'd ask, what's the message that you want to provide? Like, what's your angle and that sort of thing? And all that requires brain power, creative brain power.
Right.
Right. Because, most of my stuff is teaching and it's not really conducive to a book, actually. So I had to add a lot of extra content, that went beyond teaching.
So then during that first year where you're sort of getting your book idea, table of contents, at any point were you thinking, I don't want to do this? Like, already I'm out?
No. I was pretty, if I'm going to do something.
Just you were in the slog.
Well, plus, I had to pay Jeff. And once once I pay, there's no turning back. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and it wasn't cheap.
Well, yeah, you don't want to waste your
money. Yeah, it wasn't cheap. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't have a timeline. So, like, this could have taken 5 years, whatever. I'm just going to do this in the background. And, and whenever it gets done, it gets done.
So year one goes by. It's crazy that was year one. That was like COVID time, right? Like,
It was 2020. Going on? Yeah. I had nothing else to do anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing else was going on.
People weren't getting married. People weren't, you know, shopping.
Write a book. So you did that, and then the agent shopped it. You want to talk a little bit about that process?
Yeah. So the agent, I was just about to say Asian. The agent goes and shops the book with all the big five publishers and a whole bunch of other ones too. And what you do is you just go on a call. Like, people who are interested, you go on a call and you talk with the editor who's in charge of publication. And what was funny about that process is that the company I ultimately went with, HarperCollins, I thought I did the worst on that call. Like, I didn't have...
So is the call like an is it like a job interview?
It's not an...
Are you interviewing them or are they interviewing you?
No, they're interviewing... Like, how does it work? Well, I mean, it's more like a conversation. So they'll ask you questions like, hey, why you want to do... It's kind of like the questions you just asked me. Right?
Yeah.
And I think maybe Harper was the first one I did. Maybe that's why I felt the way I did. I didn't have all my answers in order. You know?
You didn't have your memorization?
Not memorization, but I didn't have, like, I had to come up with things on the fly, right? Because I wasn't sure what, it was my first, I think they were my first meeting, I want to say. So I wasn't sure what to expect. And then I got all these questions and I had to think and answer. Yeah. And I might have, you know, stumbled a little bit. So, whereas the rest of them went pretty smooth after that first one. Yeah.
So you do the interview process, and this is sort of facilitated by the agent.
Correct.
But was Jeff on these calls with you as well? Or were you on your own?
I'm trying to remember. I think Jeff was on them. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So then what's the next step? Do they offer you a deal? Do you just, is it like a sit and wait situation?
Yeah. So the next step is the agent sets a date where it's kind of like buying a house. You set a date. I'm taking offers until this time, and then we're going to make a decision on this date.
It's like buying a house in the Silicon Valley area. It's not like buying a house anywhere else.
In a popular area, let's say. You know how you get multiple bids?
Yes, in a hot market. Yeah, it's like we're taking bids till 5 p.m. on Friday, and then we're out.
Right. And then the offers are like all over the place. Like, there were companies that offered like a lot more marketing help and that sort of thing, but less of an advance, right? Yeah. And then there were some cool childhood publishers that just, like McGraw-Hill and I'm trying to think of some other childhood ones that just kind of struck me because I remember growing up with these books from these publishers.
Yeah, like Penguin.
Penguin's a big five. I'm talking about the non-big. Yeah, so Penguin, Simon & Schuster, HarperCollins, and I forget the other ones. But yeah. So that part was actually kind of fun after I got through my initial jitters. And so everyone makes a bid. And then on that day, I had a call with the agent. And then we just kind of talked through all the different offers. And, chose the best one.
So what, when you went into it for the interview, because to me, I personally, if I was going to do this, my thought is, well, I'd probably go with the person who offers me the most money. But I can also see someone who offers you less money, but marketing help might be appealing to other people. So for you, did you go in with I'm taking the highest bidder, or were you more interested in seeing like what the package looked like?
Okay. So for me, the package was important. I didn't want any marketing help because I just heard so many things how, you know, publishers don't help with the marketing. What's interesting is I have actually an episode with a book launch person who's had like, I think 100 consecutive bestsellers or something for his clients. Anyway, he explained the reason why these publishers don't do marketing, don't help that much. It's because their budget actually just doesn't allow it. So I would guess in theory that the smaller guys, if you take a smaller advance, they do have more resources to help you. But ultimately, you're going to be the one selling your own book. Yeah. What it comes down to. Okay.
Yeah. So you went with HarperCollins, I think.
Yes,
right?
That's correct. What I was going to say is I also wanted creative freedom because I've had friends who've had nightmares where, you know, the editor comes in and like changes the entire book or they don't want you to write about this topic. So creative freedom is important to me because I don't like going back and forth.
How does that look in a contract though?
Like, it's not
in the
contract.
Because I know you did have to make, because you did have to make some small changes to things that you wrote.
Nothing major.
Massive.
Yeah. It's kind of like a verbal thing. You just talk about it. Okay. Right. Like you just mentioned in the meeting, like, hey, you know, I really want creative freedom on this. You know, I'll take your input as a suggestion, but you know, I don't want to be forced to write anything that I don't want to write about. I think I used better words than that, but something along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's spelled out before you ever made a decision on
These are just things that you talk about in the meeting. So at the end, like they ask you a bunch of questions and they go, hey, do you have any questions for us? And then I had a bunch of questions. Probably dumb ones because I didn't know anything at the time.
Yeah. They're like, oh, this guy. What a noob.
Yeah.
So you decide to go with HarperCollins. And then what's the next step? Do they set the deadlines? Do you set the deadline? Like, how does the
actually they set the deadlines
part of the process work?
They set the deadlines.
Okay. Then it's like go time.
Yeah. After that right? it's not like at your own pace. It's like you actually have to produce something. I think the first draft, I want to say I can't remember now. It's a blur. Maybe 4 to 6 months to do it.
For the first draft of the entire
book? For the first draft of the entire book.
So you're not going like chapter by chapter or anything?
I think that's up to the publisher. Like they just want to...
Because I've seen that where not... Well, okay, I read a lot of fiction books about people who write books, which sounds weird. But in the books, they're always like, I have to get the next chapter in. It feels like it's very chapter by chapter. But, you know, that's obviously a fiction book
too. No, so it just depends on what the publisher wants. Like if they feel like you're not making fast enough progress, they might say, hey, I want the next chapter. I think because I was working with Jeff and he already has a really good name and, you know, a lot of best-selling books. They were like, yeah, we trust you. Just get it in by that deadline. And then that first draft ended up being like, okay, it was probably like 600 pages.
They're like, you don't have time for your family.
Just to give you an idea, the book ultimately ended up at like 240 pages, I want to say.
I mean, 600 pages is obscene.
It is.
Like, you don't need a book that big.
Maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it was, let's just say it was significantly longer.
It was long. I mean, I read, I think, one of the very first drafts, and it was long.
I think you got the abridged version.
yeah, probably. So, as you're in the writing process, I know Jeff helped a lot with this. Do you write it sequentially or are you just
sequentially.
Writing, you know, you're taking a look at your table of contents and writing, this is an easier chapter to write, so I'm going to write
down. Here's what happened. So we pieced together different blog posts of my writing and then I would just record audio. Like I would just narrate out what I want to cover and tell stories. And then Jeff really helped me put everything together. And maybe it's because I'm pretty verbose when I'm I don't strike me as a verbose person. Like, I'm pretty concise, right? Someone told me that in the other interview the other day. I think it was Noah Kagan. He was like, dude, why are your answers so concise? And I didn't know how to answer that. I was like, well, because when I interview someone, I hate it when people ramble. So I'll give you the answer concisely. And if you want more, you can ask for more. Right. But anyway.
Okay.
Apparently, though, I was verbose on these audio dictations for the book because there's a lot of material, which is good.
Yeah.
So Jeff always described it to me as, you know, writing the book is like molding clay, but you need to have a lot of clay in order to mold it.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, I got a crap ton of clay, so let's just get it all down and then we can mold it together.
Well, I would assume for Jeff, who's someone that I think he was an acquaintance before you started working with him. So he didn't really know.
That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah. So for someone like Jeff, I'm thinking of like putting myself in Jeff's shoes. The more information I have about you and the more I know about you and the more I hear what you're saying, even if you don't use that in the book, it leads into your personality and your mindset, which I think makes probably for better writing overall, because there's just so much more information about you that he's aware of.
Yeah, I would say after this whole experience, we know each other pretty well.
Yeah, he never wants to talk to you.
Actually, no, he hasn't been returning my calls anymore.
Weird. Now that he's gotten his final paycheck, he's not talking to me anymore. That's a hard job. I mean, like, I know he's a very gifted writer, but the more I'm hearing about your process, because I knew a lot of this, but I didn't know everything. And like, that's like, can you imagine, like, your job is to listen to people ramble on and then make it meaningful?
That's my biggest nightmare.
Like, that's a terrible biggest job. Nightmare. That's a terrible job.
Okay. So to be fair, I think he fires a lot of clients too. Like, you know, if they're too high maintenance, and I'm pretty low maintenance, I think.
Yeah.
I actually asked him that question. He was like, he hesitated.
No one's going to tell you. Yeah, you're the worst. I wanted to fire you many times, but my kids are in private school, so I couldn't afford to fire you. Okay, so you get your first draft done. If I remember correctly, over the past like year, I feel like you revised that thing 35 times.
Probably, I've read that book 20 times at this point.
Yeah.
Here's the problem: the editor supplies like a copywriter and an editor, and they go through multiple passes too. And every time that happens, and you read the book over again, there's something you don't like about it. Like, literally every single time I read it, I was like, oh, I hate this paragraph. Like, let's rewrite it. And it happens every time, to the point where, you know, it's never going to ship if you keep reading it. So at some point, you just got to... I mean, the publisher really dictates this, right? Like, this is the published date. Yeah. This is the absolute last revision. And what's clever, what they do is they make it progressively harder to make changes. So at first, it's just a Google Doc. And then they make edits, and then you approve them and whatever. Towards the end, it literally is an Adobe InDesign document, and you can't edit the document directly. You have to make comments of suggestions of how to do it. And it just makes the whole editing painful. So at the end, you can't really edit it that much anymore.
Yeah. You're like, it's good enough. So how much... From the beginning, from version one to published version, how different of a book is it?
I mean, you'll find out, because what the version read, like, way is a lot different than this end version. It's drastically different. Okay. Like, things got reordered. So, you know, what was funny is halfway through, I was like, I don't like the way this book flows. We need to rejigger all the chapters. And when you do that, like, the transitions don't make sense anymore. And you have to,
plus you can't refer back because it's in a different part. So there's probably a lot.
So that was a significant revision, I remember, because we had a deadline.
Yeah. How did it feel during that period where you were in the deadlines got real tight? Because I remember that. I remember a couple times you were on a plane and you're like, I have to read my book on the way home. Like, I have to get this done. Like, stress level 1 to 10.
I mean, I don't really get stressed that often, because I'm like, what's the worst that's going to happen? The book gets delayed a little bit. The publisher doesn't pay me the part of the advance, which I don't really care about anyway. So I need deadlines, though, because that's when things get done.
Yeah.
And the things I do always just kind of always fit within the deadline. I don't know. I think it's just how life works, right?
It wasn't stressful at all?
No, it's stressed. It's stressful, but it's not end of the world stressful. It's not like I'm going to start crying stressful. It's like, ugh.
no tears were shed in the writing of
it. It's basically like, ugh, I got to work, you know, hard, you know?
Yeah.
I know that sounds funny,
family,
but you never
you
give me...
Family, you are not first while this book is coming out.
You never give me any sympathy, because...
I don't, Mr. 4-Hour.
No, because when you... So. You know, when you have a routine that you're used to and all of a sudden you got to work, like, I don't do well at night, and all of a sudden you have to actually work at night where it's more of a struggle. It's, it, I don't know. It, I guess that's my stress. When I get knocked out of my routine, I don't like it at all.
So final revisions are done. Then what happens?
Final revisions are done. Then it's just a waiting process, kind of. And then that's when you start designing the cover. Yes. Like the flaps. You start thinking about marketing a little bit. How are you going to market and position this book? You start amassing a list of friends that you want to ask favors to. And I don't know if we want to talk about the cover. That was kind of interesting. So...
We talked about it, I think.
Oh, do we already? Okay. We don't have to talk about it again.
You can refresh. Well, what I thought was interesting and something I didn't know, and I have a lot of friends that have written books, so a lot, you know, I was familiar with most of what you were doing, but what was weird to me was that they came to you with like a book cover that looked like had been made in like Microsoft Paint, and it just was not good at all. And to me, it's like you're this massive publisher, right, that sells millions of books, and your cover art is being done by like the sixth grade Microsoft Office course, right? Probably not even sixth grade, the third grade Microsoft Office course. So that was weird to me that they didn't have more resources behind the cover, considering it's so important.
I mean, to be straight up, I think the biggest flaw of that first cover was that I was on it.
The giant picture of your face. That was the biggest flaw.
No, seriously. Like, when you pick up a book, like, you can be biased if there's someone on the cover who doesn't look like you, for example, right?
Yeah. Well, you're not, I mean, no offense, you're not a celebrity. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you see Prince Harry's, I mean, his book cover is his whole face. Like,
right, that's or Michelle Obama, for cover, example.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michelle Obama, Oprah Winfrey, like, those people are like beyond celebrity status, right? So that is going to, that's going to grab your attention. But just some
middle-aged Chinese
dude,
not so much.
Book,
yeah.
Yeah. It's just not, you don't have the level of fame, I think, to support.
Oh, no, not
that
even close. And the thing is that if you don't know who I am and then you see some random Asian guy on there, I mean, are you going to buy the book? Probably not.
Absolutely not.
So anyway, so the first step was
removing you from the cover.
Well, I got a little worried at that point because I was like, oh my God, I wonder if they're going to dictate the type of cover that I need to have, right? So I got all paranoid. And so I spent like the latter half of the week just designing probably like 8 or 10 different covers. And what I did was I went through the entire HarperCollins library of books. Every single book that they ever published in the business space. And I just looked at their designs and I picked the ones that I liked the best because, you know, they approved those designs. So clearly they would approve these types of designs.
Yeah.
And I made mine in that likeness. And then what I did is I used PicFu and I split tested all of them against each other. And then finally came down to like 3 options, which I then presented to Harper. And they were like, oh, yeah, wow, this is pretty good. Who designed these? And I was like, oh, no, I did, just based on anything. It's like, oh, maybe you could be a cover designer. I was like...
if the book thing doesn't work out.
I was like, well, I actually just kind of emulated the ones you'd already published. So...
Yeah.
And then they picked one. They changed the font. And I was like... That was probably the painful part when I was going back and forth with you. I was like, hey, which one do you want? She's like, they look the same. I'm like, no, the font here is like Sarah.
I know. There's point one difference in the depth of the weight of the back shadow, whatever.
And then the colors, which we'd already talked about, that was a factor too because I like blue because blue kind of instills trust. And so at first the cover was blue. And... You know, PicFu was just like, hey, you know, the bright yellow really stands out and made me look at the cover. And that's actually how we decided to go with the yellow. And then I split tested the tagline. This is kind of interesting. So at first, it was how to succeed in business without sacrificing what matters most. Then it became, so the first tagline was actually how to succeed in business without sacrificing what matters most. Then it became, never worry about never have to choose between family and money again. And then that was split tested against how to achieve financial freedom without sacrificing what matters most. And it was funny, the split test, and this is why I think it's important to do this process. The people that saw how to succeed in business, they were like, I don't want to start a business. Like, this book doesn't apply to me. I don't run a business or anything. So I was like, okay, that one's out. And then never have to choose between money and family again. Like, the people who were single were like, I don't got a family. I don't have to make this choice. This doesn't apply to me. But everyone wants to achieve financial freedom. And being vague about what you're sacrificing, what matters most, that what matters most is different for everybody. Some people just want freedom from their job. Some people want to spend more time with family. Some people just want to do what they want to do. And so that's the tagline that I ultimately went with. And I never would have thought about these things.
But wouldn't a single person not read The Family First Entrepreneur anyway, though?
It's possible, yeah.
I mean, if I was single, that probably would not be a book I would pick up.
It's probably true. Probably true.
So they're like, I didn't want a family. That's why I'm working 80 hours a week.
I'm not going to attract the bros. That's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's okay. That's okay. So yeah, the cover was a little bit of a slog for me personally. I don't know how many covers. Well, it was just funny because you would do it at like, I know that you were working on this at night sometimes. And so it'd be like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And you would message me with like three cover and you're like, which one do you like best? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I'm half asleep trying to watch a movie, whatever, you know? So it was entertaining.
I didn't expect an answer right away. I didn't say, I need your answer right now.
You always do. Yes, yes, you do. You're like, I have a deadline. It's midnight tonight. The book goes to print. Yeah, so the cover was fun. And then you kind of worked that out, got a cover, which you did go with the bright yellow, which I like. I'm surprised it's not, I mentioned this in another podcast, where in What About Bob, when he goes to see the psychiatrist, and he's like, I have a book that I think can help you. And then he walks over to his big mahogany bookcase, and it's all his book on the bookcase. And he's like, let me see which one. And then he pulls one out from the middle. You're gonna have your whole thing behind you be all
that
your own
that
book.
Might happen.
I think I have a book about this. Hold please. So you get the cover done, then it's time to sell, which is probably it's a whole nother episode, but like let's just talk about what has surprised you the most about selling a book, because it's not out. It's well, by the time this podcast comes out, you will be able to order it and probably get it pretty quickly.
Yeah, it comes out on May 16th. Yeah. And but if you pre-order, lots of bonuses, like a 3-day workshop, print on demand, which will teach you how to get started in e-commerce, 2-day workshop on how to make money with content, whether that be blogging, podcasting, or YouTube. And then I'm doing this Family First Challenge. That's going to start in June, where I will work with you guys in a private Facebook group to help you figure out what your side hustle is going to be. So you get all those immediately. What was the original question, Tony? I forgot.
So
now that I've done my pitch. Yeah.
So you can go on Amazon, pre-order the book. You have to order the hard copy to get the bonuses. I will link the form at the bottom of this podcast so you guys can, you'll have to give me the link. I don't know which form is correct, but if you pre-order the book, you get access to all this stuff. So one of the things that people probably don't know is that one of your goals was to hit the bestseller list, Wall Street Journal.
That's correct.
Am I saying the right one? Okay. So hitting the Wall Street Journal bestseller list, in order to do that, you have to sell a certain amount of copies of the book in a 1-week period.
That's correct.
And which is actually fairly difficult if you're not Oprah or Prince Harry. So one of the ways to do that is to have people pre-order the book. And so that the day the book goes on sale, all those pre-order sales count on that first day. So even though those sales have been coming in for the past 4 months, they all aggregate and you get credit on day one for the thousands of sales that have happened before then, which is important. And so the pre-order process for you has been very labor intensive, getting people to buy the book ahead of time. And the question was, what has surprised you the most about trying to get people to do that?
Well, I mean, you already said it, how hard it is to get someone to buy a book.
Yeah.
Here's what I think. I think in this day and age of like short form videos like TikTok or YouTube or Netflix or Hulu or the NBA playoffs going on right now. Yeah. There's so many things.
This is a bad timing for you. I mean, I'm not going to be able to read this book until June.
There's a lot of ways to grab people's attention. And yeah. I think reading a book is arguably the most labor intensive of all of them, right? You got to sit down. It takes several hours to get through the book.
Yeah.
And I think just the way the culture has been now is short attention spans.
Yeah.
I can't remember who gave me the statistic, but most people don't get through like the first fourth of a book when they buy one.
I believe that. Because one of the things that I like to look at on Amazon is that, because I buy a lot of Kindle books, or I have Kindle Unlimited, so I check whatever you check them out, is that I'll look at the list of, because they show the most downloaded, but then they show the most read, because Kindle can track, you know, you're swiping of the pages. So, I mean, I guess reading is still relative, but chances are you're not just swiping right. and not reading in a Kindle book. And I'm always curious to see like the discrepancy between the two, between most downloaded and most read. Because to me, if it's most read, especially with like fiction books where I'm not familiar with like the author, to me, it's like your book was captivating enough to keep people going through it. Because if I download a fiction book and it's not interesting after the first or second chapter, I'm not going to waste my time reading it. A business book, I'll slog through it, or a marketing book, because it's like, well, maybe it gets better in the end, or maybe it just starts out slow, something like that. But with a fiction book, there's no way that I'm going to waste any more time on that. So it's always interesting to see like what on Kindle is actually being read versus downloaded.
Yeah, so that's actually a consideration as you're writing too. And this is why I couldn't just put out like a pure teaching book, because no one would finish it. So the way it's written is it's kind of like a narrative all the way through, and you kind of learn in the process. But there's lots of stories in there. But yeah, so when I heard that, I was like, okay, great. That's going to make selling a book so much harder. You know, if you just dial back maybe 5 to 10 years ago, it was actually much easier to sell a book, right? Books were a lot more popular then. And then the rise of ebooks came, and people were like, so first off, to hit the bestseller list, you have to sell hardcover books, right? So you need to sell a physical book. And when Amazon came out with the ebooks, those really took off and started eating into the hardcover and paperback books. But since then, actually, ebooks have tapered off, and they're actually kind of on a downward trend now. And paper books are actually on the comeback. And I was just thinking to myself, why is that the case? I know you love your Kindle.
I love my Kindle.
I don't like reading on the Kindle. I really don't.
You have the Paperwhite, though?
No, we do have the Paperwhite. It's not that. Like, if the Kindle was the size of a book, I think it would be better. Like, the screen...
Oh, I love the Kindle because you can do it with one hand. It's light. A book, you have to have two hands.
And I like flipping the pages. Yeah. I like being able to see, you know, how far I am in the book instantly. I like the smell of a book, but maybe I'm biased now.
I love the smell of a book. I will say that, but nothing else about a book appeals to me anymore. And it could be that I have probably 7,000 or 8,000 books in my house. Like, I have an obscene amount of books. And so now that my kids are getting older, when they were little, like, I bought every book that they wanted to read. And so between like kid books, young adult books, business books, I have a couple thousand books. And over the years now, I've been getting rid of them. And it's like, I hate to get rid of certain books because I have books from my childhood. I know you do too. You know, that are special to me because like my dad gave them to me or something like that. So, but now that the Kindle is, you know, like I have the Paperwhite, I probably have 7 books on my Kindle right now, like in the process of being read. And I don't ever pick up, like if your book didn't matter to buy the hardback, I would have absolutely gotten it on Kindle. Because I just don't want to deal with the clutter anymore in my house. Like I want to just kind of, because when you move with books, it's a pain. It's like so many boxes.
I mean, I'm only shipping you 500, so I think
true.
You'll find space for that.
I'm just gonna go around the neighborhood. I'm gonna hand them out at Halloween. Here, kids. Drop it in the pillowcase.
Back. I don't have a family. What is it? Suck it up.
Get on it, kid.
Read the book.
You might be 9 today, but 10's right around the corner.
People like books on the shelves also because it kind of makes them look smart. You know, you got a lot of books in the back.
Yeah.
So.
You know what's funny is I've noticed for us is that since we do our lives and things like that, people actually pay attention to like what books are on the our shelf. You notice that people are like, oh, what do you, like we've had people ask us like, oh, what do you think of that book? So I won't put a book on my shelf that I can't talk about because I'm like, I don't want someone to ask me one day and go, I have no idea. It just looks pretty. I liked the color.
Yeah, actually, for my future YouTube videos, I'm going to put it on the shelf. I don't know what to take down, though. Maybe my patent. Mm. I'll still...
Yeah. I know. Patent? Your YouTube plaque? What should it be? Pictures of your children? No,
did I tell you this story? So my friend stayed at my house a couple weeks ago, and their kids came in to my office as I was doing stuff. And like, oh my God, that's so cool. Is that real? And they were talking about the YouTube button. And I was like, yeah, a lot of people have that YouTube button. I was like, oh my God, so cool. I've never seen it in real life. I thought it was plastic, but no, it's real metal and it's high quality. And I'm like, okay. And then I think I got elevated in their minds. Like,
oh, you totally
like 10
did.
Steps for that. And I was like, yeah. I was like, what do you guys think about the patent? They're like, what's that? I'm like,
yeah.
The patent took me 10 years to get that.
Yeah. I hit YouTube. And then they
read the patent. They're like, I don't understand any of this stuff. I'm like, okay, never mind. Never mind.
Yeah.
Beat it, kids. Beat it.
Get out. Yeah. So the selling the books has been, I don't want to say it's been hard, but it's been a lot of work.
Yes.
You've tried to come up with creative ways to get people to buy. It's weird to me. Like, this is where I have a disconnect with this whole thing is that You're a bad example, but let's just use like, okay, Amy Porterfield, she released a book a little bit ago. She did a lot of similar things, like had the bonuses and things like that. If I was interested in the bonuses that she was offering, I would have bought the book for price of admission because that's what you're doing too. Right. I wouldn't care about reading the book. Like I would not feel any obligation to read the book, but it feels like most people are like hesitant. Like to me, it's like, cause some of the stuff Amy offers is like way more expensive than a book.
Oh yeah.
Right. Like if I were to, cause a lot of her stuff you have to pay to be a part of. So it's like, well, I mean, I think last year I paid for that like $99 upgrade for one of her webinars. Well, she was basically giving that away with a $26 book. So to me, it's a no brainer. If I was interested in that, I would just purchase the book, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Do you know why? Is it an obligation thing? Like people feel obligated to read the book?
I haven't gotten that far yet. I don't know. I think if it's a good book, people will read it. And at some point, it's really about getting the book in the hands of people. And if they read it and they like it, then it'll have longevity. If the book is no good, you do your launch, great, and it dies, well, that's no good. So, I mean, I'm going to continue marketing the book, not the exact same way, but I'm going to continue to sell it because I think it's a good lead gen. I mean, it tells the story, tells my philosophies and all that stuff. And so if people resonate with my story and what I believe in, then they'll probably become or be more likely to become a super fan going forward.
And it is a good book.
So, I mean, you've read the unabridged version. Yeah.
I mean, I've lived.
Yeah.
I could have written, you could have given me Jeff's number. I could have written it for you. Okay. So where can people get the book if they're interested? You mentioned earlier the bonuses that you can get. There's a big challenge in June. There's a lot of workshops that are free. If you pre-order the book, hardcover only, where can people find it? I know Amazon.
Yeah. I mean, the easiest place is just go to thefamilyfirstentrepreneur.com. And it'll list, I mean, it's in every bookstore, but I have nice links that just take you directly there, depending on where you are, right? Like if you're in Canada, there's a bookstore that Canadians use. If you're in the UK, you know, there's a certain bookseller. But Amazon, you can get it there.
They're way more polite in the Canada bookstore.
And then there's a form there you fill out to get the bonuses. And I'm giving out an expiring bonus every single week leading up to the launch.
So the more bonuses you get, the more stuff you get. That's correct. Okay, so last question before we wrap it up. You have the book in your hand. There's a box sitting next to you on the floor.
There's actually three boxes downstairs. There's three boxes. Which are going to your house.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, I got the tracking. UPS just texted me. How does that feel?
It feels good. And I'm trying to, I was trying to rationalize this. I think it feels, no, I was trying to.
I'm trying to rationalize any positive feelings I might have about anything.
I was trying to rationalize why I feel it feels so good. And I think it's because it's taken me 3 years to get here. And anything that takes me a long time or a lot of work, I tend to feel better about. I don't know why that is. Like, if I finish this book in like a week, I'd probably be just like, whatever. But the fact that it was just this long, drawn-out labor of love makes it so much more meaningful. Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. Now, for more information about this episode, go to profitableaudience.com/podcast, where we list all of the tools and resources mentioned in our show notes.
And if you enjoyed listening to this episode, please go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. When you write us a review, it not only makes our day, but it helps keep this podcast up in the ranks so other people can use this information, find the show more easily, and get some awesome business advice.
Leaving a review is by far the best way to support the show. And please tell your friends, because the greatest compliment that you can give us is to provide a referral to someone else, either in person or to share it on the web.
And if you're interested in building your own profitable audience, subscribe to our free 6-day mini course, where we walk you through the exact steps needed to find your niche, build a website, grab email subscribers, and monetize your content. You can sign up at profitableaudience.com/free.
Thanks for listening.